Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of Star Cells and God. This is the podcast where we explore how the latest discoveries in science provide evidence for God's existence, God's character, and the reliability of Scripture. My name is Fuzz Rana. I'm a biochemist and a Christian apologist, and I work for an organization called Reasons to Believe, which is the organization that sponsors this podcast. And it's thanks to donors like you who make it possible for us to produce this podcast. If you want to know more about Reasons to Believe, I invite you to go to our website, www.reasons.org, or you can also follow us on social media, RTB_official. And then, of course, last but not least, please go to our YouTube channel, Reasons to Believe, and subscribe. There you can gain access to all kinds of great video content exploring a wide range of issues relating to science and the Christian faith. And then also while you're there, use the notification button so that you can be alerted the next time a new episode of Star Cells and God drops. I'm joined in studio today by Dr. Hugh Ross, the founder of Reasons to Believe, an astronomer and a well-known Christian apologist. And we've got a couple of discoveries to talk about today. Hugh, I think you're dealing with pollution.
Particulate pollution.
And I'm going to be talking about some work by Chinese scientists where they have grown humanized organs inside pigs. So
this is going to be a really healthy podcast.
Yeah, there we go. So, Hugh, why don't you start us off with your discovery?
Well, it's based on a report that recently got published by WHO, the World Health Organization. And they're basically alerting people all over the world of the risk of exposure to what they call particulate matter air pollution. Mm-hmm. And it comes into two categories that scientists have developed. Particulates that are bigger than 2.5 micrometers across, and those that are smaller than 2.5 micrometers apart. And what physicians have noted is that it's the smaller particulates mm-hmm. that are by far the bigger health risk. So somehow our lungs and our trachea are able to handle the big particulates mm-hmm. as long as they're not too abundant, but we have a real problem with the small ones. So they come up with a term for this. They call it PM2.5, which is basically a reference to particulates in the air that are smaller than 2.5 micrometers across.
Okay.
And the World Health Organization a few years ago set what they called the maximum human tolerable level, which is the maximum level of these small particulates we can handle without experiencing serious health consequences. And it's at, 5 micrograms per cubic meter. Mm. So that's not a lot. I mean, we're talking 5 micrograms in a cubic meter. But they make the point that most of the world's population is exposed to particulate matter pollution that's above 5 micrograms per cubic meter. I mean, here in the United States, the safe limit is set at 10. Mm-hmm. WHO is recommending we drop that by a factor of 2. And, we're living in California.
Right.
California last year was rated as the worst state in the union for PM2.5 particulates, not because of our industry or automobiles, but because of all the forest fires that were burning.
Ah.
And we in Southern California fared a little better than the rest of California, but we were 5 times above the WHO level for several months of last year. But there are nations in the world that are way beyond that level. And so basically WHO in their 2023 report was saying that India, China, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Nepal, and other Southeastern Asian nations are way above what they consider to be the safe limit. And at the very top of the list was India. But China, Pakistan, Nepal, and Bangladesh are not very far behind. And so they basically publish figures for cities all over the world. So you can go to their report. It's online. You can look at it for free. Mm-hmm. And it basically lists every major city in the world and what their exposure to PM2.5 was for, say, the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. So, and the city that held the record was Delhi in India.
And I think there's a slide.
We got a slide of what it's like in Delhi. So let's show that. This is the New Delhi Railroad Station. And the railroad station is actually only 200 feet from where the shot was taken. But you notice you can't see the building.
Yeah.
Even 200 feet away, the particulate pollution is so intense, you can't see the building. And 29 million people live in Delhi. So 29 million people. And their exposure level in 2021 was 126 micrograms per cubic meter.
So this is an average exposure over the course of the
year? Average exposure over the course of the year was at 126.
Wow.
So they're 25 times above the WHO maximum level.
So do you have any idea what the source of the particulate matter is in,
yes,
in Delhi?
Yes, I mean, that was a big part of the WHO report, where all this particulate pollution is coming from. To me, what was the most alarming thing in their report is that that 126 was an 18% increase over the previous year.
Oh, wow.
So from 2020 to 2021, it went up by 18%. And this photo was taken in 2017. Mm. So it was a lot worse in 2021. This is the latest year where they got data. And the data comes from satellites because there's ground-based measurements of particulate pollution. But WHO makes the point that measurements from satellites are more reliable than ground-based. Because the ground-based are highly variable. You get somebody going by that's smoking a cigar, that's going to send it way up. Whereas a satellite is basically giving the average for the whole city. So lots of nations have these ground-based measurements, but WHO is basically saying, we think the data you need to look at is from satellite data sampling. So now we could show the second slide.
Yeah.
Okay. And the next one, also taken the same year, that's the sun that you see above the building there.
Oh, gosh.
So the fact that the sun high up in the sky barely shows up. So apparently the particulate matter pollution in Delhi is so intense that inhabitants there have a hard time seeing the sun, even when it's fairly high above the horizon. And as you can see, the color of the pollution isn't all that pleasant.
Yeah.
And people are breathing that.
Yeah.
And so what WHO pointed out is that in 2021, the particulate matter pollution was at a level where the average citizen living in Delhi was having a life expectancy shortage due to particulate matter pollution of 11.9 years.
Wow.
Which means that people living in Delhi have their life expectancy cut short by 12 years due to particulate matter pollution alone. And you might say, well, that's an exception. And they go on to point out that the Gangetic Plain, which is basically that plain that covers the whole of the Ganges River, and 546 million people live in that valley. And they said the average for those 546 million people is that they're on cue to have their life expectancy shortened by 8 years on average.
Oh, wow.
So 12 years for Delhi, 8 years for the entire Ganges Valley. Now, if you look at India as a whole, where you take into account the mountains and the southern plains, but India as a whole, we're talking 1.4 billion people, their life expectancy is cut short by 5 years on average due to particulate matter pollution. And this is also impacting Pakistan, Nepal, and Bangladesh.
Right.
For those nations, they say it's 5 years that their life expectancy is being shortened. China recognized a decade ago they got an air pollution problem. So they've been fairly aggressive at trying to reduce the particulate matter pollution. But for the entire nation of China, the life expectancy reduction in 2021 due to particulate matter pollution was 2.5 years.
Mm.
And what's significant about that, China is a big country.
Right.
I mean, two-thirds of China, you're away from the big cities. You're basically out on the underpopulated plains and plateaus. And so when you look at just the eastern cities, you're talking a loss of way more than 2.5 years.
Right.
And WHO calculates the total loss of life expectancy for the entire continent of Asia, 3.3 years for the entire continent. So that includes Siberia, Mongolia, which obviously is going to have much lower particulate matter pollution. So it just shows you how bad things are, particularly in Southeast Asia. Now, the report goes on to say, what's the cause? And it's the burning of coal, wood, diesel, oil, and apparently in those nations, they burn a lot of biomass.
Yep.
So things like, you know, yak dung, they will take excess rotting vegetables and burn that. So basically any waste biomass they can accumulate, they use for fuel.
Well, when my oldest daughter was in Thailand for 2 years, there were certain times of the year it was just intolerable to be there, according to her. And that it's because they were burning the rice after harvesting it, right?
Right.
And so it was just huge fires were burning, and the pollution was just, again, very, very uncomfortable to deal with.
Right. Yeah, so it's virtually all of Southeast Asia is being impacted by this. And so they're saying if we can find a way to stop the burning, well, coal is the number one factor because coal is used extensively throughout Asia to produce electricity.
Yeah.
And so they said coal is the biggest factor. And number two is wood. People burn a lot of wood for cooking because they don't need it so much for heat except in places of northern India and China. But the burning of biomass, oil, and the wood is predominantly used as, as a fuel source for cooking. And then diesel. So you do get some from diesel and gasoline because a lot of motorcycles are running around those areas. So they are, you know, motor vehicles are now becoming a significant factor. And so they're basically saying something needs to be done because we're talking tens of millions of people dying from this.
Right.
And also it's a huge factor in contributing to global warming. And, you know, I've written previously that a lot of that black carbon soot from the burning of coal and oil and diesel is wafted up from winds and deposited on Canada. And so it explains why Canada is warming up five times faster than the rest of the world. It's all that black carbon soot.
So when that gets onto the snow, it because it's black, it's absorbing.
It's absorbing sunlight. It's melting the snow and melting the ice. And it's also happening in Siberia.
And you lose also reflectivity off of the snow.
Yeah, the snow is not reflecting like it normally does, and you're melting the snow and the ice. And it's also contributing to more rainfall. And, you know, so it's a big problem, not just in Southeast Asia. So, and the paper, the article from WHO basically ends saying, we can fix this by going to wind power and solar power. Which is where I jumped in and said, wait a minute, it's going to take at least 20 years to replace the fossil fuels in Asia with wind and solar. I mean, it takes time to scale all that up, and you have to burn a lot of fossil fuels to get those things in place anyway. So that's a problem as well. And so I'm basically arguing that the overlooked factor was, notice in North America and in Western Europe, the particulate matter pollution is way less than the rest of the world. For the primary reason, we've replaced coal, wood, biomass, oil, diesel with natural gas. And so when you look at the mandate, hey, we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to, you know, make sure we don't warm the planet too much, the nations that have had the greatest success in reducing greenhouse gas emissions have been Canada, the United States, and the nations of Western Europe. But the credit is not going to the fact that we got more solar and wind. The primary reason is that we're going to natural gas. Now, natural gas has got two big benefits. Number one, it releases zero particulate matter.
Right.
So you don't get the 2.5, you don't get
it's
the 10.
It's a gas.
It's a gas.
Right.
So there's no particulates being released. You don't get sulfate aerosols or nitrate aerosols. When you burn natural gas, it makes carbon dioxide and water. And that's a huge factor for global warming. because when you burn coal or wood, you're getting carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. When you burn methane, methane is CH4. So you got four hydrogen atoms for every carbon atom, so you're producing a lot of water when you burn methane. Mm-hmm. Now, water vapor is a greenhouse gas, but it doesn't contribute to global warming because as you pump water vapor in the atmosphere, it condenses as rain and snow or hail or dew or whatever. And so pumping extra water vapor in the atmosphere on a long term, short term it could contribute to warming, but long term average it doesn't contribute because the water vapor gets transformed into precipitation. Right. It's the carbon dioxide that's the problem. But that means that when you burn methane, natural gas, instead of coal, you're basically releasing about half the greenhouse gas emissions that you would. And so you get almost a 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions simply by substituting natural gas for coal, wood, and biomass,
right,
and oil and diesel fuels and gasolines. So, I mean, there's a movement here in the United States. You can take your car into a shop, and they'll refurbish your engine so it burns on natural gas. You need a bigger tank, so your tank becomes twice as big, but now you're burning natural gas instead of gasoline, which means no particulates, and you're releasing only half the greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. And the other big benefit is that when you go to a station and get natural gas, it's half the price of gasoline. So you save a lot of money. And I've had friends who basically converted their cars to burn natural gas just because they're going to save money.
Yeah.
So it costs about $1,000 to convert your car, but now your fuel is only half the price.
Yeah.
So, but this could be done on a bigger scale.
Right.
And so, but one of the problems is the United States presidential administration just on January 26th of 2024, they said, we're going to put a ban on the construction of LNG ports in the United States. LNG stands for liquefied natural gas. And the U.S. has been supplying natural gas to nations that don't have their own resources by taking the natural gas that's in superabundance here, liquefying it, putting it in these big container ships, and shipping it to other nations of the world. But now our presidential administration has said, we're going to put a stop to that. And what's interesting is that the Energy Commission in Congress has published a rebuttal. The rebuttal got published on February 5th from the chairman of the, National Committee on Energy Resources, basically saying this is actually going to make global warming worse, not better, because we're basically forcing the Asian nations to keep burning coal and wood.
Yeah.
And we could be supplying them with natural gas, which would give this immediate drop in greenhouse gas emissions. But they make no mention of the health benefit. And I think that's one way our administration here in the United States could change its mind, if they recognize the health benefit of supplying Asia with natural gas. I mean, to be on record of saving 50 million lives, and that's what we're talking about.
Right.
Tens of millions of people's lives would be saved if we were to have Asia, substitute coal and wood for natural gas, or probably natural gas for the burning of coal and wood and oil.
Well, and there's also another economic benefit. It seems to me, I obviously don't have data, but just intuitively, is the reduced medical costs. When you're talking about that many people suffering from respiratory diseases and probably all kinds of cancer and other things that, you know, are related to breathing, chronically particulate matter, that reduced medical costs could be huge in terms of an economic benefit.
For example, in India, particulate matter pollution is the number one cause of death. So it's actually ahead of heart disease and cancer, although that's mitigated by the fact that particulate matter exposure induces heart disease and cancer.
Right.
So it actually causes the cancer and heart disease rates to go up. So yeah, the number one factor is that it causes respiratory distress, asthma, you know, pneumonia, COPD. But number two, it brings on cardiovascular disease, so strokes and heart attacks. And number three, you get cancer as a result. So these are huge health factors, and these are not trivial in terms of suffering.
Yeah.
When you can't breathe, it's very uncomfortable. So there's a loss of productivity. So people may not need to go to the hospital.
Right.
And they may be able to continue working, but they're not going to be as productive as they would be if they weren't exposed to this particulate matter pollution. So yes, there's a big cost there. So it'd be huge economic savings just in terms of the medical costs, which are not trivial anymore.
Right.
But there's another one. Natural gas is way cheaper than coal and wood and biomass if you can produce it in abundance. Well, North America is sitting on the world's largest store of natural gas. And so instead of stopping the shipping of natural gas, if we were to encourage it and scale it up, we could actually provide the nations of Asia with a cheaper source of fossil fuel than what they have right now.
Yeah.
And that would motivate them to say, hey, if the natural gas is cheaper than the coal, then they're going to be highly motivated to say, let's switch all of our electricity generating stations from coal to natural gas. That's what happened here in North America. It's like the natural gas is cheaper. You don't get the health consequences, and you don't get the global warming effects you do with coal. It's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah.
So here in California, natural gas is the number one source of electricity, as it is for virtually all of North America and Western Europe.
Yeah.
And so if I could show the next slide, it actually shows you one of these giant natural gas tankers.
Oh, yeah.
So, and what they do is they take the natural gas at room temperature and they cool it down to 160 degrees, minus 160 centigrade or minus 262 Fahrenheit. So it's
that's probably the liquefaction point, I would imagine.
That's the liquefaction point, and it's at the same temperature as, say, liquid nitrogen.
Yeah.
So it's like it's not economically a problem to liquefy it. You don't have to get it that cold. But you can get 600 times as much natural gas into a ship if you liquefy it than if you keep it in vapor form.
Right. And I imagine it's probably comparable in terms of the shipping costs to coal. Maybe even cheaper, because I would imagine you could get probably more liquefied gas into a tanker than you could with solid coal.
You can. And moreover, rather than having the tanker itself get across the ocean burning coal, you have it burn natural gas.
Right.
It's got natural gas in the tank. So, and that way the shipping is, because that's been a big issue.
Right.
Is that, and the problem is indeed today, a lot of these liquid natural gas shipping carriers are powered by coal.
Mm.
So it makes sense. Let's switch that over to natural gas. Now you can't blame the shipping industry for pumping particulate matter pollution in the atmosphere. You also reduce the global warming effect because you don't get as many greenhouse gas emissions. And like this particular supertanker, it is able to, in liquefied form, transport across the ocean the equivalent of 162 million cubic meters of natural gas.
Wow.
That's a lot of natural gas in just one shipment.
Yeah.
But it requires having ports here in the United States that can handle a high volume of the shipping and ports in Asia that can receive it and put it into their pipelines, get it all into their buildings and homes, and basically do what Europe has done and what Canada and the United States has done.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I use natural gas to heat our home. I imagine you do too. Almost every American does. And so if that could become ubiquitous around the world, you're literally dropping greenhouse gas emissions by at least 40%, if not 50%.
And then it also allows for a much more seamless, less abrupt transition to things like solar and wind energy.
Well, that's a big advantage. This is something that can be done quickly.
Right.
I mean, you don't have to develop new technologies. The scaling up is a lot faster and cheaper. Because, yeah, I mean, I'm all for going producing all of our power without burning fossil fuels. That's kind of the ultimate goal. But the truth is we can't do that overnight.
Right.
It's going to take at least 20 years. And to do it in 20 years, I think we're going to have to tap into nuclear.
Right.
And so this is why we need to look at new nuclear technologies that don't have the toxic waste. That is feasible, but it's not something you can do overnight.
Yeah.
So this is the fastest way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But more than that, I think this is the most compassionate move we could make.
Right.
Because you're talking about saving tens of millions of lives
right.
worldwide, especially amongst the poorest peoples of the world.
Right.
And this is what we as Christians are called to do. We're called by God to relieve poverty yeah. and suffering around the world.
Right.
And so this, I think, fits right in, that if we were to provide natural gas right. to the nations of the world and give it to them at an economically a price, it would boost their economy. It certainly would boost our economy. And for Asia, you get a double boost. The fuel is cheaper, and you wind up spending a lot less money on healthcare.
Right.
So.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting, and this is a realization I had, sadly, just in the last year or so, and that is, you know, a lot of times when we look at what our responsibility is as image bearers, it's to promote human flourishing, as you're
right,
mentioning.
Right.
But we also are to be stewards of the planet. And oftentimes, I think, at least my experience is, anecdotally, is that Christians often see those two in conflict with each other, that to be stewards of the planet, to care for the environment, actually causes an incurred cost that they argue undermines human flourishing. But the fact of the matter is if you do it right, those two objectives actually work in concert with each other.
They do, and that's implied in Genesis 1, where God gives a mandate to humanity. I'm putting you in charge of the resources of planet Earth. Manage those resources for your benefit and the benefit of all their life, which implies we will not have to choose
right.
between our benefit and the benefit of all life. And that's what I loved about the WHO report. They basically said, it's not just humans that are being deleteriously impacted
oh,
by
right.
this. Our crops are being impacted. The forests are being impacted. The forests in Asia are a lot less productive
right.
because of particulate matter pollution, and they're not able to grow the food that they would otherwise be able to grow because of particulate matter pollution.
Mm.
It's also affecting the wildlife.
Yeah.
And it's affecting the herds of cows and sheep and goats.
Right.
And so this is a perfect example of what you're saying. This would be an enormous benefit for humanity, but also an enormous benefit for plants and animals. I mean, this really is a creation care no-brainer.
Yeah.
And lastly, I would argue, if we could go back to the slide that shows, that one. You know, the Bible tells us that the heavens declare the glory of God.
Right.
You're not going to see any stars with yeah. that much particulate matter pollution. You're not going to be able to see the planets. Notice yeah. you're struggling even to see the sun.
Right.
So, I mean, one of our employees here entertained a student, an exchange student from Asia, and he had her in her backyard, in his backyard, and she said, "What's that thing up in the sky?" And he said, "That's the moon." She had never seen the moon unless
wow.
it was directly overhead. So it just shows you how,
right.
in certain cities of Asia, the heavens aren't declaring much at all because
yeah.
people can't see the stars. Right. They can't see the planets mm. or the Milky Way.
Right.
And particulate matter pollution is now so intense that the majority of the world's population has not seen the Milky Way.
Wow.
So it's like, you know, for Abraham, he could see 15,000 stars, the glory of the Milky Way. And so let's restore the heavens declaring the glory of God. Maybe it'll bring more people
yeah.
into a relationship with their creator.
Yeah. Wow. Great, great stuff, Hugh. And then, of course, you've got a book that I think we want to make sure people are aware of.
Right. This is a book where I talk about global warming, climate change and particulate matter is addressed in this book. Yeah. So if you want to go and get some resources, that's it. Also encourage them to go to the WHO website.
Yeah. Great stuff, Hugh. Great stuff.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, let me go ahead and talk about what I want to discuss today. And I'm going to ease us into it, have a little bit of fun with you, if you don't mind. Because I'm actually curious about this. I know that over the years that I've known you, quite often you will complain about the scientific inaccuracies in different science fiction movies that are popular,
right.
You know, at the time. And I'm just curious, do you actually like science fiction as a literary genre, or does that frustration with scientific inaccuracies spill over into scientific?
Well, for example, Jules Verne was a science fiction writer, but he also wrote a science fiction in a way that didn't violate the laws of physics.
Yeah.
And he predicted a lot of things. You know, he talked about nuclear-powered submarines long before people even came up with a concept. What was interesting about Jules Verne is before he would write a science fiction novel, he would consult with scientists and say, what do you think is possible 200 years from now?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where he got his ideas. Now, I've told my sons, for example, I can tolerate a science fiction movie where they're violating the laws of physics once per minute. When it gets to be 4 or 5 times per minute, yeah, it's a little hard for me to enjoy the story because it just becomes too fantastical.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, I actually like science fiction a lot.
Well, I do too, but with those important caveats.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think I probably am not quite as troubled by these, you know, exceptional leaps of believability because I also realize that what at times the writer is trying to do is create an alternate reality where you now are allowed to explore, you know, literary themes and social themes and things like that.
Well, moral lessons are often explained using the tool of science fiction.
Yeah.
So.
But I do agree with you that I enjoy science fiction much more when it's grounded in reality, where I'm only really asked to suspend belief in a limited extent.
So we're both in the same camp then.
Yes,
okay.
We are. And you know, you mentioned Jules Verne.
Right.
Well, here's a picture of H.G. Wells, who
okay.
also, along with Jules Verne, is considered to be the father of science fiction.
Right.
And in those days, Wells' novels were referred to as scientific romances, interestingly enough. But H.G. Wells was actually a trained scientist. He was a biologist.
Right.
And in fact, his first book was a textbook in biology. And he had an approach to science fiction that is now called the H.G. Wells rule, which is you really limit the request of the reader to suspend belief.
Right.
You know, and that really makes the stories, you know, the best. And he worked hard to ground his work in what was scientifically reasonable
right.
and scientifically plausible. But one of my favorite novels of all time happens to be an H.G. Wells novel, and this is The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Okay.
And I remember reading that when I was in high school, and I probably have read this novel 3 or 4 times just recently within the last couple of years.
Now that you've got grandkids, I'll bet you'll read it again.
Yeah. But, you know, it's an interesting work that really explores a number of themes. You know, for example, you know, the book is about this scientific figure, Dr. Moreau, who's fairly prominent in London and falls into disrepute because he's doing these horrific experiments in vivisection.
Right.
So he packs up and he sets up shop on a remote island. And so the book is actually an anti-vivisection tome. H.G. Wells is also a social activist. But it explores themes like the role of religion in society. You know, Dr. Moreau is trying to create these humanized animals. And so this was feeding off of the idea that was just being introduced, namely Darwin's theory of human evolution, with the idea that could animals become human-like. But he also is exploring in this book, you know, what are the limits of science and what are, you know, in a sense, scientific ethics. And those themes are actually really quite appropriate because recently a research team from the Guangzhou Institute of Medicine and Health published a paper. This would have been September of 2023, where they showed that they could grow humanized organs in pigs. So they're now creating of sorts, you know, these humanized animals. And this work raises all kinds of questions about ethics and really what are the limits of science. And yet, on the other hand, this work is really very important. It's a landmark study because it's paving the way, you know, for potentially providing a source of organs for, you know, organ transplant procedures. And so that's the primary motivation for doing this work. Also, this creates a model system where scientists can now study organ development and the development of humanized organs in an animal model. So the basic science knowledge is also that this work represents is really very important. But I've talked about this before on previous episodes. You may have been involved or Jeff was involved. But I mean, currently in the U.S., the need for organs, for organ transplants, is really a very pressing medical need.
We even have an employee that's on a list and has been waiting for years.
Yes. And, yeah. You know, there's right now about 105,000 people in the U.S. awaiting an organ. In 2023, 46,000 organ transplants were done. But that still means you're dealing with half the people on that list not getting an organ.
Right.
And every 8 minutes, a new person is added to the list.
Yes.
And every day, sadly, 17 people die.
Because they're...
They don't have an organ available to them.
Don't have an organ available.
And, you know, the number one organ that people are needing are basically kidneys. And so the idea of growing, you know, humanized kidneys in pigs is really, you know, quite strategic from that standpoint. Plus, kidneys are the first organ to develop in pigs. And so it's also, you know, useful, you know, for the experiment.
I would presume, too, that scientifically it's going to be a little easier to try to come up with a kidney than a liver or a heart, because isn't the liver and the heart a lot more complex?
The liver is incredibly complex.
Right, right.
That would be very difficult to do. The heart may not be so much.
And okay.
What makes the heart easier, it isn't so much it is a more complex organ than the kidney, but the kidney is also releasing hormones that are critical for the body.
Right.
Whereas, so now you not only are dealing with, you know, the kidney being compatible with the donor, or sorry, with the recipient, but you also have to produce hormones that are compatible. Whereas the heart, I think, is easier in that respect, where you don't have to worry about those biochemical issues.
And now, the pancreas would be a challenge for the same reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, one of the approaches that is being considered, and I did an episode with Jeff where we talked about the idea of xenotransplantation. And here, you know, it's one of those ironies, I guess. But pigs are an ideal source of organs for humans, believe it or not, because the size of the organs is very similar to the size of human organs. And the physiology is fairly comparable. And so the idea is, well, could you, you know, use pigs as a source of organs? Now, there's a number of technical issues with doing this. One of the most pressing issue is immunological, where
right.
There's almost an immediate rejection within minutes of a pig organ in humans. And there are ways in which you can overcome this through genetically engineering the pig so that it doesn't produce certain cell surface sugars, which dramatically reduce the risk of hyperacute rejection. But there's still chronic rejection that takes place, and then something called acute vascular rejection that I don't think is fully understood. And so right now people are working with what's called a 10-gene edited pig that is designed to overcome some of these particular issues. Those preclinical studies using those organs work for a couple of months before they start to fail.
Moreover, you got to treat the human to lower the rejection risk.
Yes.
And that has health consequences.
Oh, yeah. But and that would be true, though, even if it was a human organ
right.
That was being donated. But yes, that's another problem. Now, there was a study done where people were successfully able to transplant a pig kidney. It's actually a miniature pig kidney into a monkey, into a rhesus monkey. And that monkey survived for 2 years, but that particular pig had 100 genes that had to be edited in order to get that success. So this is not a turnkey solution to the problem. And then there's also this issue of mismatch in organ physiology. Though the overall physiology is very similar, pigs age more quickly than humans.
Right.
So what's going to happen with that pig organ in a human? How long is it going to last? And then we also mentioned the idea that, for example, the kidneys are producing hormones that are involved in regulating blood pressure, producing red blood cells and other blood cells. So you have to now have humanized versions of those hormones because the pig hormones are not going to be recognized or may not be recognized in the same way by the human body. And there's also the concern about transmitting viruses, you know, not only to the patient, but then if that patient infects family members, you're now introducing pig viruses, you know, into the human population. So this particular approach taken by this research team is a way to try to sidestep some of those issues. Could you grow humanized organs in pigs where you have a significant proportion of human cells that have now become part of the pig organ? So it's an interesting idea that is maybe a little bit more concerning on the surface for people that might be troubled by this work than just xenotransplantation. But the studies up to this point that people have tried haven't really worked. And this research team discovered that the issue was twofold, but it all centered around one overarching problem, and that was that the human cells couldn't compete in a pig environment because the pig cells were more ideally suited for their own environment than human cells. The human cells just simply couldn't take. And so what they did is two things. Is one, and this is kind of illustrated in this figure from the paper, on the left-hand side is they explored a number of different growth medias to try to get the induced pluripotent human cells. So these would be human cells that were created from human skin cells. So these are not, not human embryos involved in this work. So they create these induced pluripotent stem cells and they played around with the growth media to find a media that would actually revert the induced pluripotent stem cell to what would be equivalent to cells in a developing pig fetus at day 5. So now you've got a match in terms of the stage of development that the human cell is with respect to the pig embryo that you're going to implant it in. They also did a couple of other things. They genetically engineered these induced pluripotent stem cells so that they would overexpress a gene that shuts down apoptosis or programmed cell death. And they also overexpress the gene that it plays a role in organogenesis. So this helps to make these human cells more competitive in a pig environment. Then on the right-hand side, they also wanted to genetically engineer pigs so that they actually would not produce kidneys during embryonic development, right? And so what they did is they found two genes, the 6-1 and the SAL-1 gene, that play a role in directly in controlling kidney development. And they, through a sequential series of gene editing experiments, they basically created a pig embryo that wasn't able to produce kidneys. And so what you see here on the right-hand side, if you go to the top figure, that's an embryo that is null in these two genes. And so when you implant that embryo in a surrogate, you get basically a kidney deficient embryo. And so then what they did is what's shown here on the bottom slide is they took these human-induced pluripotent stem cells that had been genetically engineered, and they infused it into a pig embryo that was, again, deficient in these two genes that control kidney development. And then they were able to implant those into sows, into surrogates, that then gave rise to pig fetuses that survived up to 25 days and 28 days before I think the pregnancy had to be terminated. And so this is, we can skip this slide. This is just showing a summary of that. But this is a really interesting figure taken from the paper. What they also did with the induced pluripotent stem cells, which can, again, these were human cells, is they added a gene that produced a protein that would fluoresce red. So in the top diagram, you see the wild type. This is a wild type pig fetus. Mm-hmm. And so you don't see any kind of indication of red fluorescence. The middle panel is of the embryo at 25 days. And you can see that red, the red light where the developing kidney would be. And then you also see that on the embryo that at day 28. And they estimate somewhere between 50 to 60% of the developing kidney consists of human cells.
Wow.
So this is a huge... Now, it required them implanting about 1,850 embryos into 13 sows, and they only got five fetal embryos to this stage.
To this stage.
So it's a horrifically inefficient experiment, but it's a proof of principle. Right, and they readily admit there's all kinds of work we need to do now to make this a viable, you know, operation, a viable procedure. But something else that is of concern, particularly for animal rights activists, is you want to make sure that you don't have human cells making its way into the into neural tissue. And because there have been some studies done with rats and mice where people have implanted like human neural progenitor cells into the brains of developing rats and mice, and the resulting pups actually perform better in intelligence tests than the wild-type animals. And so the concern is that by having human cells that may make their way into the neural tissue, that you could actually elevate the sentience or the self-awareness or the intelligence of the animal, which now for some people raises questions about should that animal be afforded human rights. So part of the justification for working with pigs to begin with is that they don't have the level of sentience that, let's say, a monkey or a chimpanzee would have, because chimpanzee organs would work better in xenotransplantation than pig organs for humans. But the problem is that there are two problems. One is chimpanzees have a much higher level of sentience, so it feels a lot crueler. But also, chimpanzees have a very long gestation period and only produce a single infant, whereas pigs have a very quick gestation period and they produce 13 to 20.
Also, pigs are a lot easier for humans to handle than chimpanzees.
Right, right. So there's economic reasons, you know, and scalability reasons, but also there's concerns about sentience. But but this is a study or some images showing, in effect, the neural tissue in the fetus. And the important point is that we don't see any red fluorescence, which means that that those human cells are now designed to compete in a kidney-deficient fetus in that, you know, in the context of the kidney very well, but once they get outside of that tissue, they don't have any kind of competitive advantage. So this is actually a really good thing. So, you know, interesting work to be certain that really is paving the way for maybe an alternative even to xenotransplantation, or that may be used in conjunction with xenotransplantation to really provide a source of you know, human organs. If you could have a pig kidney, for example, that has a large proportion of human cells, you're going to dramatically eliminate a number, or at least reduce the severity of almost every one of those issues that beleaguers xenotransplantation.
Right. So, yeah, I think it makes sense to target kidneys first.
Yeah.
Because that's where the biggest demand is.
Yes.
And it's probably where you're going to have the least technological issues.
Right.
So.
Now, believe it or not, with xenotransplantation studies, the heart is actually even an easier organ to use in transplants than the kidney is. Right, the kidney, because of the hormones that the kidney releases, but the heart is a much later developing organ, and so they have not tried that particular study, but this is providing a roadmap for how you might look to make other types of humanized
organs.
And
they've gotten 28 days of development of the kidney organ.
Yeah.
So did they give any hint as to what they think their success rate might be in terms of getting actually a functional kidney that could be transplanted?
I think because this was a proof of principle experiment, the expectation is that this should be that there's a number, they discuss a number of levers that they can play with that ought to dramatically improve the efficiency, you know, and, you know, also probably push the development much, you know, ultimately you'd want the pig to be born and to grow.
Right.
Now, you know, this kind of work, though, again, going back to the island of Dr. Moreau, raises all kinds of interesting questions, right, about, you know, that maybe we could summarize it with one question: should we play God? And, you know, from a secular bioethics standpoint, most of the concern seems to be with animal rights issues, which are not insignificant because, you know, the question is, once you start genetically engineering an animal, particularly to this degree, the question is that actually going to cause that animal to suffer to a greater degree than it would if it was a wild type animal? And then, of course, if this is scaled up, and you're trying to create a source of organs for people around the world, you are, in a sense, doing a type of factory farming.
Well, especially if you got a success rate of 0.01%.
Right.
Now you got to have a lot of pigs.
Right. And, you know, again, it's admittedly a very poor success rate, but because it's proof of principle at this point, I don't even consider that as being an issue at this point. Now, if they can't improve that success rate or can only marginally improve it, that really limits, you know, or you just brute force the technology to get the organs that you need. But, you know, from a Christian perspective, and we've already kind of discussed this, our two mandates as image bearers is to promote human flourishing and to care for the environment. So as Christians, we should be concerned when we see these kinds of experiments about animal cruelty. But on the other hand, this could mitigate a lot of human pain and suffering. And, you know, we've been granted dominion, you know, over the creation, right? And so I think doing this kind of work with animals like pigs is falling underneath the dominion that God has given us as rulers over the creation. Right, so I don't see this as really stepping outside the bounds that God has for us as human beings. I see this as being consistent with the dominion God has granted us.
And, well, particularly if the pig's suffering shows up quite late in life.
Yeah.
I mean, if that pig is going to be harvested for pork chops, it's like, okay.
Right.
What's the difference?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. When it comes to this question, you know, like, should we play God? My response always is, well, we have no choice but to play God because we're image bearers. The question really becomes, you know, are we taking God's place, right? And I don't see this work as fundamentally taking God's place. I see enormous amount of compassion associated with this type of work that is, I think, fully in line with biblical principles, whether the researchers identify as Christians or not. There is an enormous amount of compassion towards people that are suffering that's represented in this work. I'm sure there's monetary gains to be made and things like that. China really wants to be a leader in biotechnology. I'm sure that's part of this. But still, even in the midst of those, you know, less than desirable motivations, there's still really a lot of good that can come from this work.
I agree.
Yeah. So anyway, but one final point, and then we can wrap everything up. And I think you and I would probably both agree with this, is that when I see these kind of advances that are taking place, and you know the troubling ethical issues connected with it, but also the enormous promise, I really want young people in the church who have an aptitude for science and medicine to really think about pursuing careers doing this kind of work, because it's having a Christian experts working in these fields that is going to really ensure the highest and the best use of the technology and really help to navigate what can be some at times troubling ethical issues.
And ensuring that indeed the animals are properly cared for and,
right,
you know, that we look at their benefit as well as our benefit. So.
Right. So anyway, all that to
No, this is amazing. I mean, yeah, the idea that we could actually produce kidneys from animals that don't have the rejection problems,
yeah,
that could be a huge benefit for people all over the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think if there's an overarching theme in our two discoveries is really that as Christians, we need to care for the environment. We need to care about human flourishing. It's part of our mandate. And that instead of this really flawed perception of what Christianity is about as being anti-environment and, you know, lacking concern about other creatures and their suffering on the planet, the Christian faith actually provides a grounding for environmental concerns and the concerns about animal welfare.
That's something I noticed before I became a Christian, was going through the holy books of different religions of the world. It's the Bible that really preaches creation care.
Yeah.
I wasn't seeing that in the other holy books. It's unique to the Bible.
Interesting.
So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, we'll bring this show to a close. Thank you so much, everyone, for watching this episode of Star Cells and God. Make sure that you go to our YouTube channel, Reasons to Believe, and subscribe. Use the notification button so you're alerted when the next episode of Star Cells and God drops. Don't forget to follow us on social media and check out our website at reasons.org. And remember, it's viewers like you that support the work of Reasons to Believe and help us provide the resources so that we can continue with this particular program. And last but not least, I want you to remember that the more we know about science, the more we have reasons to believe. Until next time.